Mr. Mason, repeated the judge, bringing me back from my daydreaming, I asked you if the defense wishes to say anything before sentence.
No, Your Honor. As far as I could see, there were no mitigating circumstances that I wanted to bring to the court's attention. I couldn't claim the young man was the product of a deprived or broken background, nor could I try to excuse his behavior by reference to some past abuse. In fact, quite the reverse was true. He had been educated at one of the country's leading private schools, or at least he had until he was 17, when he had been expelled for bullying the younger boys, and then threatening the headmaster with a broken bottle while being reprimanded for it. "The prisoner will stand," announced the court clerk. The young man rose to his feet slowly, almost smugly. I stood up too.
"Julian Trent," the judge addressed him, "you have been found guilty by this court of perpetrating a violent and unprovoked attack on an innocent family, including a charge of attempted murder. You have shown little or no remorse for your actions, and I consider you a danger to society. You have previous convictions for violence, and you seem unable or unwilling to learn the errors of your ways. Therefore, you will go to prison for 8 years. Take him down."
Julian Trent simply shrugged his shoulders and was ushered down the stairs from the dock to the cells beneath by two burly prison officers. In spite of the 8-year prison sentence, it would be, in fact, only half of that before he was back on the streets, arrogantly using his baseball bat to threaten and beat some other poor soul who crossed his path. November 2008.
"Hi, Perry. How you doing?"
Fine, thanks," I replied. My name isn't Perry. It's Geoffrey. But I have long since given up expecting the other jockeys in the changing room to use it. When one is a lawyer, a barrister even, with the surname Mason, one has to expect it. I was secretly quite pleased that I was addressed at all by the professionals. They were together day in and day out, going about their daily work at the many racecourses around the country, while I averaged only a dozen or so rides a year, almost always on my own horse. An amateur rider, as I was officially defined, was tolerated as long as he knew his place, which was next to the door of the changing room, where it was always coldest.
"Any juicy cases, Perry?"
asked a voice from up the far end. I looked up. Steve Mitchell was one of the elite, constantly vying with two others for the steeplechase champion jockey's crown. He was currently the reigning champion, having won more races in the previous year than any other, and he was lying third in the present campaign.
"Not just the usual. Kidnap, rape and murder. Don't know how you do it."
"It's a job. And it's safer than yours."
"Yeah, suppose so. But some guy's life depends on you.
They don't hang murderers anymore, you know.
But if you mess up, someone might go to jail for years. They may go to jail because they deserve to, no matter what I do."
"Does that make you a failure?" he said, buttoning up his blue and white hooped jacket. I laughed. "When I win, I take some of the credit. When I lose, I say that justice takes its course."
"When I win," he said, "I take all the credit. And when I lose, I blame the horse."
"Or the trainer,"
piped in another jockey. Everyone laughed. Changing room banter was the antidote to danger. 5 or 6 times a day, every day, these guys put their lives on the line, riding more than half a ton of horse over 5-foot fences at 30 miles an hour with no seat belt, no airbag, and precious little protection.
"Unless you stopped it."
The voice had a distinctive Scottish accent. The laughter died. Scott Barlow was not the most popular regular in the jockey's room. Like Steve Mitchell, Barlow was one of the big three, and he currently led the title race by the odd winner or two. The reason Scott Barlow was not the most popular of colleagues was because he had a reputation of bleating to the authorities about his fellow jockeys if they transgressed the rules. Professional jockeys were not allowed to bet on horses. Some of them did, of course, and it was reliably reported to me that Scott Barlow had been known to go through his fellow jockeys' pockets to find the illicit betting slips to give to the